Hello and welcome to Nerdzilla, the show for owners of the Sinclair ZX Spectrum,
the Commodore 64,
the Amiga 500,
the Sharp MZ700,
the Amstrad CPC,
the BBC Micro,
the Apple IIe,
the Apricot,
the TRS-80,
the Atari ST,
the Micro B,
and every IBM PC AT clone ever made.
You are listening to Nerdzilla with Andrew Hogan and Joel Reinberger, the show made by nerds for nerds. It's on ABC local radio, digital and online, and also available from our website as a podcast. Andrew, mate, what have you been up to since last we spoke?
I caught Superman 2 on television and discovered two things in it that I can think are unbelievable.
Yeah.
I can't recall watching Superman 2 for a long, 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 long time. Firstly, the three Kryptonian supervillains, Zod,
yep,
Ursa, and Non,
yep,
have got the most ridiculous superpower that no Kryptonians ever had. They at one stage in the film, they point their fingers at somebody, beams of light fly out of their index finger, pick up the person at the other end, and throw them into the air. Like some sort of laser finger telekinesis.
Telekinesis, yeah.
What on earth is that about? that was a bit annoying. What was more disturbing was, you probably don't recall the end of the film. So Superman gets into the cabinet because he tricks Lex Luthor into telling him that if he goes in this cabinet, he'll lose his superpowers, but he's reversed the polarity of the neutron flow.
Flow,
so
yep,
it's actually all the people outside lose their superpowers. And then Superman casually murders the three of them. They've lost their superpowers. He fights General Zod and pushes him into the bottomless cavern in the Fortress
the
of
glacier,
Solitude.
Yep.
You never see him again. Lois pushes in Ursa and Non sort of manages to fall in by himself because he's three kinds of stupid. So Superman just murders three people at the end of the film. Fantastic effort, buddy.
As he would. I've actually got the Richard Donner special edition on Blu-ray of that at home.
Does he kill him in that too?
Yeah, he kills him in that too.
It's like completely outrageous.
But look, I really love those old Superman films.
Look,
for
so
all
do I.
That there's silliness about them. I love Christopher Reeve being Clark Kent. I think he's so good as the bumbling twit. He just does it so beautifully.
Oh, no, they're great, great films. But that just struck me on last Saturday night as like, hello, seriously? That's just craziness. And you know, we were talking about The Phantom Stranger the other week.
Yeah.
And my
he's mixed in many origin stories.
I discovered what the deal is. In the Secret Origin series that DC put out, which was meant to tell little snippets of the origins of all the superheroes, they had to do one on Phantom Stranger, and they didn't want it to actually be definitive because they didn't want him to have...
They like the mystery.
So they got three or four separate authors, including, I think, Alan Moore, to write four different origins for him in his issue of Secret Origins, and which is why there's sort of lots of stories about where he's actually from. But in the New 52, in of all things, the free comic book day single standalone issue they put out, it looks as though they might be giving him an origin in the New 52. And I'm not going to spoil it because it's pretty big.
You did tell me about it before the show. Yeah. And it makes sense of some of his costume, which has never really been explained.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I'm a bit sort of, I don't want him to have one. I don't want him to have any defined powers or origins because that's what's cool about him. I just want him to have, you know, the Roger Federer on his head, and a pretty cool sort of cloak. But anyway, I thought that was interesting since we were talking about it. And I've read Darwin Cook's Before Watchmen, The Minutemen, issue one.
Oh, what's it like? Because, you know, it's been, you know, much touted and much waited on.
I liked it. I genuinely liked the story. I love his artwork. I mean, no one else is going to do 50 superheroes better than Darwin Cook. And it made me, I got to the end of it and I want to know what happens next. So, you know, I can't see the problem. Now, the other thing was that you gave my wife a book to read, didn't
in
you?
In fact, a trilogy of books I gave her to read. Tansy Rayner Roberts, their publisher, sent a little batch of her books to me, and I had a little read and went, it's just too girly for me. Not that it's bad, just that it's girly. And so I handed it off to Christine and outsourced it to her.
So we had a little bit of a chat last night about the first book, Power and Majesty, and here's what she said.
Okay, so we're talking about Power and Majesty, the first in the Creature Court series by Tansy Rayner Roberts. And let me quote from the back of the book. She almost missed the sight of a naked youth falling out of the sky. He was long and lean and muscled. He was also completely off his face. Christine, What's it about?
You've got my attention. Okay, well, there's a war taking place in the city of Effleur that most inhabitants are completely unaware of. Every night there's battles between the sky and the members of the Creature Court, shapeshifters who change into animals. The main character is Velody, and she finds herself in the middle of this war when she discovers that she's an incredibly powerful shifter. She's capable of being the power and majesty. She's capable of ruling the whole court. The females in this book are the more likeable characters, particularly Velody, the main character, and she tempers her powers with pragmatism and compassion. The men, with the exception of the character MacReady, who I actually really like, they give him an accent. He's an islander. I'm not sure whether he's Tasmanian, Irish or Scottish. Most of the men are weak, vicious and, for the most part, incredibly angsty.
Oh.
There are some beautiful descriptions in this book. I particularly like the use of the sewing and stitching analogies to describe the shape-shifting and the flying. It's a bit slow to start with, but it picks up pace considerably after the first third, with plenty of battles, bloodshed, power struggles and lust. But I felt it somehow lacked the element that fantasy writing has to transport the reader into another world.
Does it make you want to go back and read the others?
Yes, definitely. I've got enough of an investment in the characters now that I want to know what happens.
And look, I've got to ask you, what about the cover? What's going on there?
Yeah, a lot of people said that when I looked at some stuff on the net that they didn't really like the cover. And look, neither do I, because this is, it's pretty, you know, dark and angsty in places. And yeah, if I just had to pick it up off the shelf, I wouldn't be drawn to it that way.
But you're thinking you might go back and check out the second one. And is there a third one?
Yes, there is. And definitely there's, you know, it's some trilogy novels can stand alone, but this one is definitely the first part of a trilogy. And I've definitely got an investment in the characters now, because there's heaps of room for the character development. I really want to see what happens to the other female characters, actually, Velody's friends.
Okay, so that's Tansy Rayner Roberts' Power and Majesty. Now, honey, more importantly, would you like to hear my flame war debate for this week?
No, I don't think so. Sorry.
Mrs. Hogan there doing a her guest review for us there on the Tansy Rayner Roberts Power and Majesty book there. Now, so, you know, the lesson being, don't judge those books by their cover.
Literally.
And look, speaking of Andrew, I had a designer send me covers for my book.
For your book?
For my book.
Fantastic.
He sent me a couple of options. There they are on my iPhone.
Oh, yep.
That's number one.
That's very, very sort of Vertigo comic style.
Very, very horror-ish. And this is the second one.
Oh, even better.
Yes, yeah, I like that one too. I've been taking them around all of my friends and saying, what do you think? What do you think? What do you think? And if it was leaning really heavily one way, I would probably follow that.
Mm.
I've done enough marketing in my life that I know that's the wise thing to do, but it's about 50-50.
Very Dave McKean.
Yeah, that one is, isn't it? The second one is, and that's the one I'm going to go with, is the second one. So when my book's eventually out, that's hopefully what it's going to look like. It's
well done.
Been very exciting having that. I've got a whole bunch of really interesting messages this week. Read this SMS that arrived on my phone, Andrew.
Dear a beneficiary of the Global Lottery Award 2012, send an email with your email address to Mr. Wayne Boris for claim. And there's an email address from bluemail.org. Really? You won? How much? Wow,
and
you
Andrew,
must be so happy.
The thing is, how can you not trust someone named Wayne Boris?
That's got to be a superhero alter ego, isn't it? That's Wayne Boris. He probably stretches.
Now, the other thing that's been messaged to me recently is the D&D beta. Wizards of the Coast are doing a beta testing of their new version of Dungeons and Dragons. So for our final episode, which is coming up in a fortnight's time, the videoed episode, let's play a game of new style Dungeons and Dragons.
You are on.
And what sort of character do you want to be?
I'll be a gnome, of course.
A gnome magic user. If you're having, well, I'll dungeon master your way through an original Gary Gygax adventure. News time. Andrew, it's been a big month for gay superheroes in Australia. Following in the brave shoes of Archie, the two big superhero comic companies have had a couple of major sort of gay announcements. One is Marvel Comics have announced that their character Northstar is going to marry his boyfriend. And the other is that Alan Scott, the Green Lantern from Earth 2 in DC's New 52, has come out of the closet. Well, not really, is it?
No.
It's more that he's just is and always has been gay.
The Alan Scott, who we now have on Earth 2 in the comics being written by James Robinson, is gay, yes, which is fantastic. Although it is a bit sad because being gay, of course, he won't
will most likely have children, one of his children, the superhero known as Obsidian, in the old DC universe, was gay.
But now, I actually quite like it because they're making one of the mainstays of the team, not a secondary character, not a character that's mostly off-screen just so they can say, yeah, here's some diversity. He's one of the main guys, and it's just normal.
More importantly, Earth 2, Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman don't exist. So Alan Scott is the most powerful hero on the planet.
Ah.
So, big call.
Very big call. Also in comic news, an original drawing of Tintin by the artist Hergé has just sold at auction for 1.3 million euro. Now, this has been widely reported as the most expensive comic ever sold, but that is wrong in two different ways, as far as I can tell. One, it's not a comic.
Yeah.
It's a cover illustration from a comic, but what was sold was a single individual artwork, not a comic in any way. I think that's quite a real distinction. You know, if I bought a painting that had been used as cover art, I wouldn't call that a book.
No.
It's not a book.
Clearly.
Two, there's been a few comics auctioned for more than this, at least one of them being the Nicolas Cage $2 million Action Comics number one.
It was a bit hard to miss that. In fact, I've had people who wouldn't call themselves hardcore comic fans coming to me and saying, Hogan, is that right what I read? And I went, no.
No, it's not right at all, no matter where you read it.
Warner Brothers are going to make a Justice League film. Yawn. Look, it's impossible to believe that the studio that owns the rights to the world's greatest and most well-known superhero team haven't been able to get a film out. But it's been reported that they have contracted screenwriter Will Beale to write a first draft. Well, here's hoping.
A little blog called the Ocracoke Island Journal has reported a strange and silly correction made to War and Peace on the blogger's Nook e-reader. So he was reading it on his Nook, War and Peace. And let me quote from him. As I was reading, I came across this sentence. It was as if a light had been nooked in a carved and painted lantern. Now, thinking this was just a glitch in the software, I ignored the intrusive word and continued reading. Some pages later, I encountered the rogue word again. With my third encounter, I decided to retrieve my hardcover book and find the original translated text. For the sentence above, I discovered this genuine translation. It was as if a light had been kindled in a carved and painted lantern. So the suggestion is that someone from Barnes & Noble has done an auto-replace to get rid of the word kindle and replace it with the word nook, but on classic literature.
Because clearly Tolstoy was writing about e-readers.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Just insane.
It's crazy. The US Department of Defense thinks it has found a loophole that will allow super-powered stink bombs to be added to the US military arsenal. This is good. The problem, of course, is that chemical warfare is outlawed under international conventions. But the definition of a chemical weapon is one that activates the trigeminal nerve. This is where your cranial nerve knowledge comes in handy, Joel. Mm. The trigeminal nerve deals with sensations from the face, cheek, and jaw area, but not smell. Smell is the olfactory nerve. So, the Pentagon is now working on what they call the malodorant missile. I know this is true.
Wasn't that your nickname in primary school?
Thanks for that. All I can think of is, dude, stink bombs are in every joke and magic shop, aren't they? So surely this is not clever.
The International Institute for Species Exploration has released its 2012 list of the top 10 new species. Now, each year, up to 20,000 new species are discovered and put into scientific journals.
I thought you meant the movie species.
Now, this list shows off the amazing diversity of these finds, including the devil's worm, which lives almost a mile down in a South African gold mine, making it the deepest living multicellular creature. There's a bright blue tarantula found in Brazil. It's just as creepy and hairy as all the usual tarantulas, but it looks like the Blue Man Group have sneezed on it.
It's an avatar tarantula.
Now, I dare you not to snigger at this. There's a millipede so big, it's known as the wandering leg sausage. I knew that would blow your mind. Come on, this is the news. The wandering leg sausage. But an even better. That's not even the joke I was going for with that particular piece of news.
Sorry, can't talk.
But my favourite is a mushroom found in Borneo, which has been named after a cartoon character. Spongiformer square pantsy eye.
Oh, well done, you eggheads.
Now, apparently the guys who discovered this put it into the magazine, and the magazine said, no, we are not going to call it the SpongeBob mushroom. And they said, you totally should, because people will pay attention to it and be interested in science. And here we are paying attention and being interested in science, ladies and gentlemen.
On the Nerd News on Nerdzilla. Look, in the next installment of Sending Things to Space in a Weather Balloon, a group of engineering students from the University of Illinois have sent up an action figure away team that included not only Captain Jean-Luc Picard, but also Commander Riker and Data, plus James T. Kirk, and get this, custom-made action figures representing Star Trek filmmakers J.J. Abrams and Robert Orci. All of them were sitting glued on top of models of the Starship Enterprise. Now, the whole shebang got to 100,000 feet, and they sent up 6 high-def video cameras, so the footage is really, really terrific. The link will, of course, be on our blog.
If someone gets a terrible virus on their computer, what's the typical smart-ass thing that people say about it, Andrew?
Oh, you should have backed up.
The other thing about where the virus comes from, what sort of sites have you been looking at?
Yeah, okay, yeah.
But according to internet security firm Symantec's recent data, porn sites aren't the place most likely to infect you with malware. You're 3 times as likely to download a problem from a religious or ideological site.
Ooh.
So your church blog is probably dirtier than that Batman fetish site you visit, Andrew, and it's pretty easy to understand why. Adult sites have been online for a long time. They're money-making ventures managed by experienced online operators, so security for them is just par for the course. But most of the religious sites are being put together by amateurs, just using some basic blogging software or whatever. They have the best of intention, but they don't have the experience, they don't have the skills, and that's where a lot of malware is being planted now.
Now, we can't let the nerd news end without mentioning the death this week of Ray Bradbury, the legendary science fiction author who wrote such classics as Fahrenheit 451 and The Martian Chronicles. So, here's 3 things you probably didn't know about Ray Bradbury. 1, he was good friends with stop-motion animation guru Ray Harryhausen. Number 2, The Martian Chronicles was made into a TV miniseries starring Rock Hudson in 1980, and Bradbury's own 2-word review of it was just boring. And 3 was that he actually won an Emmy Award for his screenplay of The Halloween Tree. So, Ray Bradbury, legend.
He was also descended from a woman who was found guilty in the Salem witch trial.
Yes, yes, correct.
And but apparently, you know, 100 people spoke out saying, no, she's fine, she's a lovely woman. And,
she's right, yeah.
And it was sort of petering out and they managed to escape with her or something and she lived to a ripe old age.
That's fantastic. Legend.
Finally, MIT have developed a method of injecting fluid through the skin without a needle, much like the hypo spray on Star Trek. Now, I thought this had already been invented because I remember getting something like this used on me when I was a kid. Mm. I got a TB shot here in Tassie because there was a TB scare here. And there was no needle. It was just a gun thing, and it had the end of a shower, like a shower head on the end of it, little holes in it, and it just went pow and zapped it through your skin. Now, they're called a jet injector, but apparently they're very quick, but they have cross-contamination problems, which is why you don't see them anymore. But this new one works differently. The stream of fluid it spits out is incredibly narrow, narrower than the proboscis of a mosquito.
So you don't feel it. Yeah.
It'll get in and you don't feel it. And there's no needle. It just pushes out that liquid so fast that it acts as its own needle. It actually pierces through the skin, and then the rest of the fluid flows a little bit more slowly through the hole that's made. And when the fluid stops, it's such a small hole, the elasticity of your skin just closes over the top of it. So amazing little piece of technology. And MIT has said they've tried it on animals. They don't notice themselves being injected, and they're hoping to start human trials very soon.
You're listening to Nerdzilla, created for the listening pleasure of all humankind.
Well, this week we went and saw Ridley Scott's new possibly alien prequel Prometheus with our good friend Damien Larkins from local radio in Tasmania, and here's a little bit of us chatting before the film.
Gentlemen, have we all been sucked in by the various trailers and viral marketing?
I don't watch trailers. That's not true.
No, I don't know where that was coming from.
I don't know. What is this about?
Damo, what is your summation of the story that you know?
I think it's about Charlize Theron bossing people around in space.
Because, Joel, I can't recall seeing more footage from a film in you know, leaked things and trailers and 30-second spots and everything like that, and yet know so little about what's actually going to happen.
I love that they did a couple of viral things that were completely outside of the movie itself. It was things that gave you an insight into the movie, but not the movie.
I believe the basic premise is there's a hero who goes on a journey.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's the one thing I didn't see in the trailer.
Is Batman in this? Is Commissioner Gordon in it? Because he's in everything.
Did you get the notice on any sort of social network today that if you turn the Twitter symbol sort of sideways, it looks like Batman?
The bird, the little tweety bird?
Yeah, yeah.
The foul whale.
The foul whale sideways? Neither of those things are true. Who said that?
Oh, hang on. This will keep recording and I'll look it up. It's from Andrew Mitchell. And he says, if you turn the new Twitter logo upside down, it's Batman. I don't know how new it is, but it's the Twitter logo. And here we go to the picture.
But someone's put a Batman on it.
No, I see it. Definitely.
The thing is, the shape is exactly right, is the original shape. But if you just make one side of it a little tiny change of colour, it does become Batman.
Why has he got a mullet? Why has Batman got a mullet?
That's sort of, you know, representative of his cape, Andrew.
Yeah.
Or he's channeling, I don't know, Paul Stanley at a kiss.
Bit of Paul Stanley there. bit of Ivan Marek, Richmond Ruckman. Great mullet on him.
I believe it's part of a wider DC conspiracy to reduce his rogues gallery to 140 characters or less.
That's very meta. I don't even understand what that means. Yeah. Anyway, Prometheus, yeah.
I think it's going to be long, but it's going to be really awesome.
Fassbender's in it.
Yes.
I like that.
And I'm not going to do a live tweet because I actually want to watch it more than I want to
be smart about it.
Oh, you want
to actually pay attention to this one, do you? Yeah, fair enough. Okay. Yeah, I don't think... It's sort of a film that seems... It's a bit scary. Like if I make silly comments during the film and you tweet them, someone will reach out of the screen and punch me in the face. Because it's sort of got that earnestness, hasn't it?
Although I was just thinking, can you imagine if there had been 3D in the original Alien? How many nightmares of face huggers you'd be having?
I reckon what you want is 3D plus the ability to control the fire sprinklers overhead. So people get this sudden spray of water on them in the middle of the chest bursting scene.
Is there going to be a semi-sentient killing machine alien that knows how to work and a lift? It was always the real problem I had with aliens. How did that thing know to press buttons?
No, if you see the fourth one,
yeah,
in Alien Resurrection,
yeah,
there is a bit where they teach it how to press buttons and stuff, and they teach it how to react,
yeah,
to things. And they go, oh, you're smart, aren't you?
But that must have happened in like about 2 seconds in Aliens.
If you walked into a lift, what would be the first thing you did if you'd never been in one before?
There's a whole lot of...
When my 2-year-old walks into a lift, Andrew, he presses the buttons.
I might have a wee in the corner. You might think it was a small room that's provided for that. It goes up and down.
Essentially, if you walked into a lift, you'd never seen a lift before, you'd walk in, you go, hey, nice little room, then the doors would start closing, you'd freak out.
And then it opened.
What is going on in here? Why am I stuck?
It'd be a different outside. You'd think you'd been a TARDIS.
Anyway, Prometheus, in a moment, we'll be back once we've seen it.
It's Nerdzilla, an ABC podcast.
You are listening to Nerdzilla on ABC local radio, digital and online. Joel, a few months ago at the Supernova Expo in Melbourne, you had a chat to two rather pleasant geeks of the week, didn't you?
Yeah, amongst the other people floating around, and like Will Wheaton and Jim Kelly, who we've already had on the show, we had the Phelps twins, James and Oliver Phelps, who played Fred and George Weasley in the Harry Potter movies, the 8 Harry Potter, yeah, movies. You know, when you've become world famous before you can drive a car, where do you go from there? I started out by asking them how old they were when they got the casting call and how much they knew about Harry's world at that point.
We were 14 when we got the first call, and we'd read the first 3 books. The fourth one had just come out, I remember, a couple of days before we went for the first audition.
So did you realise the scope of what was in front of you?
No. On a word, no. I had no idea. If you'd tell me, like, 12 years later, we'd be in Melbourne, me and hundreds and thousands of people, and I wouldn't have believed you, so it's pretty cool.
Pretty exciting, yeah.
Did you even realise, at least 3 movies? Like, what was the contract put in front of you?
We knew they'd always do 2, and then it was It's going quite well. Maybe 3 and 4, 5 and 6, 7, 8. Yeah, it was always going to keep going. So I think we determined after the first premiere that it was going to be a big thing because a lot of interest is in it. But yeah, never to the size I think it's got to.
Now, was this your first major acting role?
It's our first acting role, full stop. So yeah, we're going to start, might as well start there, right?
And the premiere, tell me about being to the premiere of this first movie. What was that like?
The first one was, to us, it was like, wow, this is a big premiere. But the last premiere was just insane. They took over, instead of doing it in Leicester Square, they did Trafalgar Square. And they reckon there was into the well over 30,000 people just watching the premiere alone. The longest red carpet in history. It was just insane.
So taking you back to that sort of a 14-year-old selves again, and you've read the books, what scene were you looking forward to doing the most?
I think the first book, it was the King's Cross scene when they run through the wall for the first time. I remember thinking, how are we going to do that? Like,
and the answer is?
Magic. Computer magic, yeah.
Yeah, it was certainly a lot more simple than I thought it would be, yeah.
Did you just run through a gap?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I have heard of people actually trying to run through the wall at King's Cross itself. And they've actually, I think they had to put a sign up saying, remember, you are all muggles.
Now, look, there are some really spectacular action sequences in it. What was the most physically demanding thing that you were asked to do on set?
Physically demanding? I think there was one where we did a lot on the harnesses and everything, the jerkback sequences and getting thrown high in the air and landing on crash mats, which was all, you know, to be told you're doing that for the day, you're like, yeah, all right, I'll do that. But yeah, I mean, after a couple of takes, that gets a bit tiring, but it was never too bad though.
Did you have to do much training? Do you have to actually be fit for it?
Definitely helped. Definitely helped. I mean, like,
but whether you were or not is another thing.
Yeah, I'd say so. Yeah, I think it was more like it would benefit you if you were a bit healthier than just sitting in Krispy Kreme donuts all day kind of thing.
Now, when did you figure out that Fred was going to die?
When the fifth book came out. When the seventh book came out, we just about to start shooting the fifth movie, and I was in Japan. And I remember I was on the bullet train in Japan. I was reading it, and the guy came around asking for my ticket, and I literally just read the paragraph when he dies. So I was a bit like, it's really weird. It was like reading like your best mate's died or something. And meanwhile, this ticket inspector is shouting at me in Japanese, telling me to get my ticket out. Like, so that was quite a surreal moment.
How did you feel when you found out that one of you is going to die?
Well, I first read, obviously, earlier in the book, you read that George has lost his ear. So I was like, oh, that's not very good. And then I read that about Fred dying. I was like, it's not too bad, actually. You know, it's not as bad as it could be. Yeah, but again, it was on the same train ride.
Now, Wikipedia, which I inherently don't trust because it always gets things wrong when I'm about to interview somebody famous, it mentions a prank incident that required some refilming to be done. Instigated by you two guys. It's very vague.
Yeah, again, I think that's Wikipedia working its magic there, literally. No, we never had to refilm anything after a prank. It was.
But there was a prank.
There was many pranks, actually, on set, but never what would jeopardise a lot of crew being called back, because there's a lot of crew who work there, and I wouldn't want to be the reason they're working on the day on a Saturday, you know.
So pranks? Can you lay out a couple for us?
There are a couple. Guess the ones, in case kids are listening, it was
well, the first
rule we always had was only do a prank if you would be willing for it to happen to you, kind of thing. So it's like
fair rule. Yep.
Yeah, fair rule. It's your fair game. But I mean, there was one where I remember a cast fell asleep in front of a TV screen, and we just have to be playing Call of Duty on the Xbox. So we turned up to 100%, got out the machine gun and started firing. And he literally woke up like as if he thought he was in a war zone. But we all started shouting. I'm like, get out. So that was pretty fun to do.
Now, so were you typecast in the film? Did somebody see that mischievousness in the two of you?
I think it was more a case being told when you're 14, yeah, just mess about, which is all right. Yeah, I can do that. And then we try and get it. And then obviously it's like, oh, no, we're method actors. That's all it is. And then, yeah, I think we were probably the most immature by the end of it.
You definitely were.
Now, tell me about because it is a real ensemble sort of cast, and you've all come through and grown up together. Are you all still in touch, or have you found that there's a couple of people that you are naturally drawn to and the rest you only see at red carpet events?
We still keep in contact with, like I say, 99% of, well, yeah, quite a lot of people who are in the cast. We actually played golf with Tom Felton the other week and saw him get a hole in one.
It's pretty cool. I've been playing that game for 10 years, never got one, and he just like pops up and does it.
Yeah, and we're meeting up with Rupert next month. So yeah, we're still very much in contact with everybody.
Now, are you relieved not to be redheads anymore?
For my hair, I am. Yeah, it got like every 3 weeks we'd be getting the roots touched up and the eyebrows bleached and everything like that. But yeah, it's certainly easier to for me anyway to not do it. But I mean, I didn't have a problem being a redhead.
What's next? Now, I understand one of you is planning on being a professional golfer.
Yeah, all right, keep dreaming.
No, it's one of those things. I'm a very avid golfer, but I don't think that'll ever happen. But it was definitely a pipe dream. But no, I mean, we're keeping in with the acting. We're actually in America at the moment, working on some stuff out there, and then heading back to the UK at the beginning of the summer back there. And yeah, plodding along anyway, coming up with new ideas.
Is it going to be the twin thing for you forever, or are you going to be able to separate and be your separate selves?
Yeah, I've actually done a couple of things on my own without Oliver, and Oliver's down to do a job without me. So I think we're going to be like keep splitting up and coming back together. Like I don't know.
Well, we thought about never doing the twin thing again. We thought, all right, that's it, 10 years of doing that, and I'll do that. But one of the guys from the cast actually said to us, no, if you can use that as your new, you know, that's a unique thing, you want to use that. So that's a good idea, though.
Well, look, if Mark Shepherd and Morgan Shepherd, father and son, can continually use father and son, you know,
yeah.
I'm sure it makes use for you guys as well.
Yeah, hopefully.
Look, naturally, I hope both of you go on to much bigger, better things with your lives, but if you don't, if you end up, you know, having a nice career, but Harry Potter ends up being your highlight, that you're forever defined by a decision you made at 14.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
I think to the teachers at school who said, oh, I shouldn't go for the audition, you want to concentrate on your work.
But you should always stay in school. But I guess that, you know, it's one of a thing in the career, and it's going to be very hard to top something as big as Potter. But, yeah, we'll try and find something.
James and Oliver Phelps, thank you so much for being on Nerdzilla.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Cheers.
Nerdzilla in review.
We now take you to outside the cinema after we'd finished watching Prometheus.
Do you know what? I feel bad because I'm not underwhelmed. Because, look, that was fine filmmaking, but it was... Do you know what? It was actually like a late 70s, early 80s sci-fi film. Did you know how it things lingered, things took a long time to happen, and you weren't unhappy about that, but truly it's almost as if he's gone back and made a film that was made before Aliens, not just set before it.
Yeah, look, I've got to say, I was engrossed the whole time too, and there were two or three high points in terms of horror and shock, but at the end of it, I'm looking back going, where was the climax? I don't know if it necessarily had one, or when it was over, if I thought that was it.
Yeah, it was a strange film in terms of the structure of the film.
Yeah.
Because yes, you're right. I won't say that it petered out. In fact, it ended the only way that it could have ended. But it was, yes, it was a little bit strangely constructed. Look, you know, I don't think, I'm going to go out here and say, I don't think it added to the Alien experience for me. I don't think that it told me anything that I couldn't have worked out pretty obviously.
And yet it was a lot of stuff there was new.
Oh, it was nice to know. It was nice to know. What I mean is it does not add to the canon of Alien, and I think if you went and watched Alien and Aliens without seeing that film, they would still be as good.
Yes, yes. Now, any stopping points, anything that stopped you believing?
Well, no, as a movie, as you're saying, like physically put together, you know, it did run like that pre-era movie.
It was long. Basically, we're used to 90-minute movies, and that's over 2 hours. It was long. Yeah.
But it did have, you know, today's special effects, and the 3D, I think, was done really well. You know, he didn't do all that crazy frenetic action that a lot of 3D directors kind of do, and you lose it.
Though there was an ad on there for a 3D TV, which was the worst 3D I've ever seen. They had 3D effects, and they made a 3D ad, and it was appalling.
A lot of the, really fast-moving stuff that your eyes just don't have a time to actually...
But even when they were slow, the little planes bursting out of the television, they were jerky and weird.
Maybe we were watching 3D through 3D and it just ruined it.
It went to 6D, which doesn't work.
No, 9D, cubed.
Oh, cubed, exponential.
Yeah, yeah.
Cubed to the power of E quotient. And, you know, the music was impressive. There was a soundscape to that film. There was a real soundscape.
Look, I found there were a couple of things. There was one particularly intense scene, which the person was in a lot more pain than they needed to be.
Yes. No spoilers, but that was a really silly machine.
Yeah. You know, and I'm just thinking, why are you doing it that way? Why didn't you just do it the obvious way?
Yes.
And I'm going to take my helmet off and keep it off, even though I've discovered a slimy alien creature. What are you kidding? Isn't that just, you know, you're a doctor, you know, isn't that just basic knowledge that if there's germs around, you put your bloody space helmet back on?
There's that old school science fiction, though. If there were stairs, I was certain they were going to run up them.
Yep, yeah, pretty much. Yeah. There was a large amount of Gilligans in that party. And then normally in these, and let's face it, that was really, for all intents and purposes, a horror film. And yeah. Normally there is one Gilligan, but no, they were all doing ridiculously appalling things.
And the guy who just got so angry in the first few, little bit of it, and just, you know, you've travelled 40 billion light years to go to an alien world, and then you get angry because you see something slightly unexpected and go off your brain. Surely they check your psyche for that before you leave.
Well, go to Alien Planet, find aliens. Oh, my God, no!
That's too much for me. I'm out of here.
Actors, Idris Elba, always good. Love watching him. He's so textured and he's so just laid-back cruisy.
Yeah, except for that guy who went crazy for no reason, which I just couldn't believe for script and for acting. Everyone else was pretty good. Charlize Theron was so intense the whole time.
Mm. Yeah, she does play a good angry and evil character. You know, she's won an Oscar for Monster as well. But, yeah, she was a bit parachuted in, you know, just to be the angry person. I don't want to give too much away. I'm finding it very difficult to talk about this movie without giving spoilers.
And it's interesting how much we care about the spoilers for this film. Why is that?
For a change, I do. Yeah, I don't know why, but yeah, I do. Totally.
Is it because we actually respect Ridley Scott's storytelling and the need for surprise?
Well, no, I think because genuinely that's a movie that you would spoil. Like, if there's ever the word spoiler, you would spoil that film to the point where I'm glad we talked about this before the film. I got no idea what this is about. What on earth is it going on? I'm glad I didn't know, because that would have diminished almost all the enjoyment, to be quite honest.
And Guy Pearce being the old dude, I'm sorry, cast an old dude to play an old dude, that old makeup never works, because old people's faces get thinner and looser, and the skin moves more, whereas they have this, it looks great in a still, but when he's moving, it just doesn't work. He just doesn't look old.
When you go and see the film, dear listeners, was he trying to sound like Rupert Murdoch? Because I reckon he was doing Rupert.
Send an inquiry, Rupert.
Yes. I reckon he was doing that Australian who's lived in America for too long accent. And he was a most powerful rich man on the planet, wasn't he? So who knows? Yeah. Just throwing it out there.
I think, without giving away the spoilers, you know, and why I don't want to give away the spoilers is, for me, I enjoyed the ride. It was visually entertaining. The characters were pretty good, despite being a bit two-dimensional. I did have the squeamish moments, did have the scare moments, but overall, I was a bit disappointed, and it raises a lot more questions for me than I think it was trying to answer.
Agree.
I don't want to spoil it, because I want people to have their own opinion of it.
Damien, so you're thinking that there's going to be a prequel sequel coming up soon?
An in-betweenquel, perhaps.
Did I just say prequel?
No, it's not.
Cut that bit out.
It's been obvious since the trailer came out. It had the spaceship from Alien in it. It has to be a prequel. That's been on the trailers for
Ridley
ages.
Scott was trying so hard in the media to say that it isn't a prequel but set in the same universe, and I believed him.
You fool?
I know, and then I think that's what disappointed me.
No, look, it's got the same company name. It's got the same spaceship. It's a prequel. There's no doubt about that.
It's, to be quite honest,
teenagers in hoodies running past you up the street wearing red shoes. There is something bad going on in Hobart Town.
Always something bad going on. It's three nerds standing under a streetlight talking about a science fiction film.
Waiting for Vietnamese food.
Yeah, look, there actually has to be a sequel to that. There has to be. I could not even imagine that it's perfectly set up, and it's not perfectly set up to lead into Alien at all.
Also, I wanted to argue with your point that just because it's in the same universe, although it's got different characters, doesn't necessarily have to be a prequel. Otherwise, you know, Batman could have been a prequel to Superman. They're in the same universe. That's similar.
No. There's much more relationship.
There is, though. But there is the choice not to be a sequel, although you are set in the same universe and you do have a crossover of characters.
There's no choice that not to be a prequel to the other movies.
No choice with that movie. But there is a choice. And he chose not to make it a prequel.
Yes. Correct. I actually know what you're saying. Yes. You're mental, but I know what you're saying.
He could have set in the same universe an entirely different storyline, but he chose to just go down the prequel route.
What if you made...
What you're saying then is it was a prequel, and I'm right.
Yeah. Well, no, but I'm not saying it wasn't a prequel. I'm just saying he said it wasn't going to be, but then it was.
What if somebody made four superhero films, hear me out, and then got Joss Whedon to make a film with all those superheroes in one big film plus two others? Is that a good idea?
I'd see that.
Yeah, thank you. That would take it $1.2 billion. Guaranteed. So anyway, summing up, I give it 3.5 slimes.
Yeah, look, I'm actually with you. Like, really impressive in some ways and a couple of bits that didn't quite grab me in otherwise.
I think I'd go, what are we doing out of five, are we? Yeah. Okay, can I say 2.6?
You can say pi.
That would make it out of 100.
Okay.
Out of five, which really means out of 10.
Okay.
There are 10 possible markets.
Okay, 2.5.
Oh, that's low.
I did enjoy the ride, but I've left disappointed. Too many questions.
Not enough boobies.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Too much slime. I get enough of that at home.
Flame War on Nerdzilla.
It's old school versus new school on Flame War today.
It is. It's the ultimate old school versus new school, isn't it?
Yeah, look, Dungeons & Dragons versus World of Warcraft. Dungeons & Dragons is probably the original role-playing game. Mm. The game played with maps and books and dice and invented characters where you take on the role of a character with a particular skill set in a fantasy world and go off trawling through dungeons or rescuing people from vampires and castles.
And it's almost the universal role-playing game because there's very few role-playing gamers who haven't played it, at least at some point.
It's the one by which all others are judged. World of Warcraft is the definitive MMORPG, massive multiplayer online role-playing game. Andrew, would you like to describe what World of Warcraft is?
Yeah, it's Dungeons and Dragons on a computer, isn't it? Isn't that the point of this debate, really?
Very much. Very much it is. Which one is the better for playing? Andrew, it is your turn to go first. I actually checked it this time, so I know it's your turn to go first.
Well done.
360 words from...
The inescapable fact in this debate is that fundamentally, World of Warcraft and Dungeons and Dragons are the same thing. Wizards, warriors, swords, spells, monsters, and mayhem, and some dubious personal hygiene practices. So, if they're basically the same game, then World of Warcraft has to be cooler because it's on a computer. I mean, think about it. Everything is cooler if it's on a computer. I mean, who gave a rat's about Scrabble before you could play it on Facebook or your phone? Like, no one? And what about Solitaire? 99% of kids these days don't even realise you can actually play it with a deck of cards and not Windows. And poker is now apparently an online game that you can practice at home with playing cards as long as you play the real thing on the internet. Being a computer game gives World of Warcraft all the wins. For a start, you don't need to wear pants when you're playing. Now, last time I tried that with you guys at D&D, well, it didn't end well for me, did it? You know, but I digress. You can't play Warcraft with a crappy computer, so you have to build a kick-ass gaming rig, which is actually awesome fun on its own. What do you have to do before you play D&D? Roll up a character? Without question, the boringest, most mundane thing ever. Dungeons & Dragons has so many rules. Version 3 Dungeon Master's Guide is over 300 pages, and so is the Player's Handbook. I mean, seriously, how is that good? It's not. It's stupid. Nobody should have to read that much crap to play a game. Like, you can play World of Warcraft without reading anything. In fact, you can play it while being totally illiterate. Okay, check out YouTube. That fact is not in dispute. D&D insists that you know all the mechanisms for how everything happens in the game. But who cares? All I care about when playing Warcraft is did my ridiculous attempt to kill a dragon with a level 1 spell succeed? Currently, more than 11 million people are playing Warcraft. How many people are playing D&D? Like 37 at last count. And none of them is Leroy Jenkins.
Everything is better on the computer, Andrew.
Yeah, totally, yeah.
Cooking.
Yeah.
Camping. You prefer camping on the computer?
I hate camping.
Swimming.
I hate swimming.
Bonking.
No comment. On the computer? Like, I mean, because we could break it.
And there's just as much stuff to learn, I find, in MMORPGs, where you gather to do this and what's the procedure for doing that. And if you
want
to join a guild.
That's all part of the game. That's not part of the minutiae of how it works.
It is part of the minutiae of how it works. You have to read forum after forum to get into how these things go.
Tables and rubbish and dice and it's just silly.
This is actually the joy of the new version they're bringing out is they're deleting rules.
But more about that later.
Making it less complicated.
You need to counter my argument.
World of Warcraft is only a pale shadow of Dungeons & Dragons. If D&D was the girl you had a crush on at school, WoW would be the flick animation of her you drew in the margins of your maths text.
Because you did that.
If D&D was a juicy steak on your plate, WoW would be watching a reality TV cooking show. If D&D was a Jack Russell Terrier, WoW would be the little dog eggs it lays in your backyard. World of Warcraft is completely unoriginal. You know what the great innovations are that it's brought to fantasy gaming? Waiting for software updates and for the server to load. Waiting for some guy in Tokyo to turn up at your raid. Slogging through endless, dull quests to level up. And acting like utter, misogynistic morons. Screaming at newbies, making crass come-ons to women, and creating sexual positions with any passing night elf. D&D has no boring slog through repetitive quests. If you don't like it, you can change the story. If you're bored, your character can do something else. It's actual role-playing rather than RPGing, so you can do anything. And that's why every D&D game I ever played was full of surprises. Tricky traps, clever solutions that we came up with for in-game problems, bizarre conversations with non-player characters, and unexpected trays of nachos being pulled out by the host. While WoW is always the same, you explore, you fight, you win or lose, and go on to the next scene. In D&D, you investigate mysteries, set your strategies, connive with your buddies, surprise the GM with a crazy way to achieve your goals. And you don't act like a prat, because if you do, you won't get invited back. While WoW has no effective prat filter, in fact, it seems to be more of a prat magnet. D&D is forging real-life social connections through a group exercise in creativity. WoW is what you do in your tracky dacks on a Friday night once your nose is too sore and empty to continue picking it. It's the great circle of life. You have no mates, so you play WoW, and because you play WoW, you have no mates. While D&D is defined by the friends you play it with, and it runs on the power of imagination, not the limitations of software.
Oh, very poetic. The limitations of software.
Yes, the power of imagination versus the limitations of software.
How did you not invoke Leroy Jenkins? Because I was hoping that once again we would use the same argument to come to different conclusions, because how often do we do that?
I knew you would have to. I knew you would have to. But hey, you know, people can, on rare occasions, do the Leroy Jenkins in D&D and go, stuff what the rest of you are doing, I'm going to charge in. Okay, and then set off all the traps and attract a million bugbears to come and destroy you.
It's usually what I do. Yeah, I will say, look, you know, D&D is not my favourite role-playing game.
What is?
Traveller and Toon.
I've never played Toon. I've heard lots of good things about Toon.
It's the anti-D&D. The rule book is all of 30 pages, and it has one overriding thing, and that is that in the absence of an exceptional circumstance, every action has a 50% chance of succeeding. So I'm some cartoon character. I'm being chased. I run off the side of a cliff. I have only a 50% chance of realizing that I've run off the cliff. If I don't realize, I'm going to keep running. Because that's what the roadrunner does. If you don't realize, you don't fall. Everything has it's a beautiful way of doing it. I had a fantastic Toon character. My favorite character was a talking toilet called Mr. Crapper.
Did you ever play Hunter?
No.
I believe it was actually written by some Australian guys. Again, only like a 20-page sort of, you know, cardboard-bound manual.
Yeah.
And what it was is basically you're an alien redneck coming to Earth to hunt humans.
Lobo.
And it's great fun. You just careen around in your spacecraft and kill things. And you might have a special mission to get a particular type of human, you know, or to go to a particular place to get humans. And what you end up doing is shooting up your hometown half the time.
So you're like a predator.
Except you're dumb.
Okay.
You're sort of a dumb redneck. Predators are organized, and they have this whole culture of hunting and killing things. Whereas this, you're just some twit with a rifle and a scope who's going, yeehaw!
You're the predator who missed the spaceship.
You're Billy Joe Bob the Predator.
Billy Joe Predator. That's fantastic. Yeah.
Well, weren't we just saying before the movie today that the Predators, the one that's interesting and exciting is always the broken tusk
broken
predator.
Tusk.
But that would be the redneck. You know, if you saw a person with missing teeth, you'd go, redneck, wouldn't you?
And any predator who's dumb enough to get close enough to something to break his tooth off, he's probably not that good.
Yes.
Look, I'm probably willing to give you this one, to be quite honest.
Have you ever actually played WoW?
No. No. Never.
Neither have I. And you know why? Because I played Warcraft, and I really didn't like it. Not World of, but Warcraft, the standalone real-time strategy game.
Oh, yep.
And for the first year or so that World of Warcraft was out, I thought it was the same thing but done online, and it really didn't appeal to me. But then I found out it's much different. It's one character, which I quite like, you know. That sort of works for me.
You played Skyrim for 27 years straight or something?
Oh, that's more or less a first-person shooter. But it's not multiplayer Skyrim at all.
Of course not, no.
Very different setup indeed. So yeah, I never quite got the chance to get into it. And by the time I realised what it was and that I might like it, it was like, A, my computer probably can't cope with it, and B, everyone I know who's into it has 9 90th level characters, and I'm going to have to start from scratch, and I can't be bothered.
It's not a tower defense game,
I just don't want to be a noob all my life.
Hi, this is Mark Shepherd, and you're listening to Nerdzilla.
You are listening to Nerdzilla on ABC local radio, digital radio, and online, or maybe as a podcast. We are the show made by nerds for nerds. Joel, we want to know something from our listeners, don't we?
We do. Look, we've got one episode left after this before our final official episode wraps up. There will be the odd other podcast coming out when Andrew and I get the time, but the official season on digital radio is over as of our next episode. And before then, we want to know, if you've been listening to Nerdzilla, what you have learned.
What have we taught you that you didn't know? What's changed your life about Nerdzilla?
But especially what you've learned from Nerdzilla or from being a nerd, because we want to assemble a bit of a list. If you can do something that will make us laugh, then it should make it into the next episode.
It might have been what you've learnt from a nerd news segment, what you've learnt from our gadget watch, or possibly from one of our flame wars, although what you've learnt from the flame war is probably that I just can't follow any rules at all.
To get hold of us, you can email us, nerdzilla@hotmail.com.au. We'll also stick this question up on Facebook and on Twitter, and you can tweet me at @ABCNerdzilla.
Don't forget our website, abc.net.au/local/nerdzilla, and we'd love to hear from you there too.
And until next time,
Leroy Jenkins!